It's time to have your high five moment with High Five Casino, the top social casino where the action and real prizes never stop. Fun spins and big wins are right at your fingertips with over 1,000 games, including High Five Casino exclusives. High Five Casino is always free to play with free coins given out every 4 hours. Sign up today and get free welcome coins you can spin for a chance at cash prizes. Visit highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
You're welcome back to The Hard Shoulder. Kieran Cuddihy with you until 7 o'clock. I'm delighted to be joined for the Thursday interview this week by Richard Boyd Barrett, the People Before Profit TD. Richard, you're welcome to studio.
Thanks very much, Kieran.
I suppose you're generally here talking about the issue of the day, as it were, less so about yourself. Though you have been here speaking about Ulysses on occasion. We might get to the time in UCD in a few minutes. Your personal life, though, there's elements of it that people know nothing about. That there's aspects, and I suppose the adoption probably that people know some of. Did you know growing up you were adopted?
Yeah, I did. I think I was told when I was about 7, as soon as my parents thought I could kind of understand, I suppose. So that was a good time to be told, because it sort of came fairly naturally. And I was lucky. I had a great family who brought me up, and, you know, I had a happy upbringing. So it wasn't disturbing to me to discover I was adopted. But obviously you'd be curious over the years.
Yeah.
But it was never like a major pressing thing. I always thought at some point I might look into it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just seemed fairly natural. And if you're happy at home, I suppose, if your upbringing wasn't great, it might be a slightly more disturbing thing.
Yeah.
And I'm very conscious, since all the issues about mother and baby homes have come up, that for other people, that experience was, in some cases, really horrendous. So I count myself lucky.
I'm kind of curious, though, because I assume your parents who brought you, David and Valerie, isn't it? That they, I'm sure they tied themselves in knots a little bit. Did they, in advance of telling you?
Oh, I'm sure they did, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I haven't really talked to them about that, but yeah, I'm sure it must have been a difficult thing for both of them. But as I said, you know, they were great parents, and we got on well. Didn't always see eye to eye with my dad politically over in the years that followed. He wouldn't have been naturally a socialist, I would say. Although I'm always trying to convince him to move further in that direction. But yeah, I mean, it genuinely for me was never, it was never a sore spot or anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Does that make you unusual, though, do you think? And I appreciate what you say about a happy upbringing, but for most people, it would be a human reaction to have a period of introspection after something like that. And you mightn't have had the vocabulary at the time to recognize this is a period of introspection, but you know, to kind of question about your kind of place in this family dynamic and who gave me up and why, and, you know, are these really my parents? All of that type of stuff.
Yeah, I know what you mean. But, I mean, obviously,
it's interesting that that didn't.
It
or
didn't.
That it, or that it did, and for some reason, you've forgotten it.
No, but genuinely it didn't. I mean, I was quite happy to talk about it to my friends. It was never something I was sort of, you know, embarrassed to talk about, to say that I was adopted. And of course people say, well, are you curious about who your parents might be? And I was curious, but I didn't really go chasing. I always thought at some point I look at that. And I always sort of felt that there had to be a good reason. Do you know, there was never any sort of blame attached. And I suppose as I became more aware of politics and the viewpoint I would have on things like that, I certainly think, and it's very important to stress for those that, in my opinion, were forced to give up children, that it was by the church, by the state, by the sort of overweening sort of morality largely emanating from the church, that it wasn't the mother's fault, you know, that these things happened. They were put under intolerable pressure. So I think the only thought I really had about it was because I became a science fiction fan from a very early point, because I was always a big reader of fiction and particularly like science fiction. And I always liked the idea of parallel existences.
Okay.
You know, that you had two parallel existences, alternative universes. And then when my mother, my biological mother, came and found me, that kind of became even more real, because you literally did have two existences. But in my case, that was a very, very good outcome, because I went from having one great family that I loved to having a massively expanded family.
Do you still think in those terms? Lots of people do. I do it myself. I think, what if I had studied this? I wonder where I'd be now. Or what if I had taken that job? Or what if this happened? And often I hate to imagine too much, having done anything radically differently before I met my wife, because I think I probably wouldn't have met her had I done anything because different. I met her through work. You know, I think that's the only way our paths might have crossed.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm cheating if I imagine having studied something else in college.
Yeah, I do.
What might you have done differently? I mean, academia is kind of what jumps out for me.
Yeah, well,
outside looking
I think
in.
So. Well, to be honest, I mean, I stumbled into politics. It was not a plan for me to get involved in politics. I was studying English literature, and I certainly, one of the thoughts I had at the time is academia in that area. And had I not stumbled into politics, that might well have.
You would have been political, though, studying.
There's a great
quote about. Can I read it about you?
Someone described you
when you were back tutoring, kind of doing the masters.
Yeah.
Richard could often be found converting innocent new art students to the virtuous life of socialist militancy.
Oh, that's definitely true. That is definitely true. But at that stage, I had started to get interest in socialist politics. You know, even though I was studying and then tutoring for a while in English literature, I already had stumbled across socialist politics. And that was all as a result of my experience in Palestine after my first year in college, where I ended up and lived and worked in Palestine for about a year.
Tell me, how did you end up there? What was the plan there?
Well, there were some mates of mine who weren't going to college. There was very little work. They decided they were going to go to London to work on building sites to get work, as so many people did. I decided to go with them, originally just planning to work on the building sites for the summer and then come back. But they weren't coming back after the summer was over, and they wanted to go somewhere else to look for work and somewhere a better climate. And then I said, I'll go with you, you know. And so we ended up getting one-way tickets to Tel Aviv. We had no idea about what was happening, but we arrived literally about a month before the first Palestinian Intifada broke out. So we walked into the first Palestinian Intifada.
And before we get into that, I mean, was this to kind of go off and work in a kibbutz and stuff?
Yeah, that was the plan. Yeah. But we didn't get on the kibbutz. That was the other interesting thing. They didn't let us on the kibbutz because we had one-way tickets, and they thought they sort of didn't.
These guys might never leave.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. So they wouldn't let us on the kibbutz. So we ended up working in these farms down the south on the desert, on the Jordanian border in the Negev desert, where it was real slave labour. I mean, hard labour, and paid very little. But the good thing about it was, whereas on a kibbutz you wouldn't have met Palestinians or Arabs, on these farms, because they were commercially orientated, we ended up working with Palestinian day labourers who were coming from refugee camps in Hebron. And we very quickly kind of, you know, became friendly with them, and they started to explain their history, their suffering, and giving us day by day accounts of the Palestinian uprising that was happening, which was mostly young people getting out and protesting about the lack of opportunity, the lack of freedom, the fact that their colleges were being closed down by the Israelis at the time because there was protests. I immediately identified with their kind of suffering. I hadn't known much about it before.
And was that a reflection on you, or was that a reflection on Ireland, or just international coverage of this issue?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one of my friends was knew about this stuff a bit, right? But I didn't.
So there
really
was a bit out there.
There was a bit, yeah. And of course, we'd all seen mostly sort of very stereotyped representations of Palestinian terrorists from like hijacked movies from the 70s. Do you know what I mean? I didn't really know the real history of it. And it was only when I became friendly with these Palestinians who were my age, and they were just explaining their life and their history, and in particular fella I became very friendly with, and just explained how his family had been driven out in 1948 out of what is now in Israel, had been living in a refugee camp ever since. And he was, you know, denied all the life opportunities that you would just expect people to have. And I could see the discrimination against Palestinians and Arabs. It was really entrenched, and it was all pervasive in terms of the way even the farm worked. There was really systematic, pretty obnoxious racism directed against Palestinians and Arabs. So I was pretty appalled by that. But I was also very inspired by the kind of heroism, really, of young Palestinian youth coming out on the streets and protesting, often facing pretty horrendous violence at the hands of the Israeli military.
And so you did this kind of fill you with some, I suppose, revolutionary fervour or zeal when you came back from Israel. But that drove you towards... is this a fair description, kind of pacifist socialist politics? Because it might have driven others towards picking up a Kalashnikov.
I wouldn't call it pacifist, but I came back looking for ways to kind of get involved in Palestinian solidarity work. I went to amnesty meetings, but at that time they weren't really taking up the Palestine issue. And they were mostly focused on letter writing, and I felt that was a bit passive. I mean, no disrespect to Amnesty, and by the way, they produced a brilliant report recently on apartheid in Palestine, which is really an amazing and accurate indictment of what I saw. But I was just looking around for people who understood, and then eventually I went to a socialist workers movement, as they were then, meeting. And I've been to a few meetings, and they seemed to really get it. They knew the history. They produced some very good literature on it, and you know, they characterised the setup there really as a kind of something that paralleled our Irish history and the penal laws and colonialism in Ireland and the forms of resistance to it, and the role of big powers in supporting Israel, basically to have strategic influence in the Middle East for oil, and all that just made sense to me, and it matched what I'd seen, and that's how I got involved with them. And one thing went from one thing led to another, as it were. And I remember then in 1991, the first Gulf War broke out, and there was quite a big anti-Gulf War 1991 movement, and I got involved in that. And that was campaigning against the first US invasion of Iraq. And simultaneously also, I think it was that year that the X case happened. And I hadn't a particular interest in that issue before, but I was appalled at what happened around X. You know, a 13-year-old rape victim could be prevented from going for an abortion, even though her family wanted her to, and she wanted to. So I was appalled by that, and I remember joining the protests around that issue. So it was really, I literally stumbled into these things, you know, and socialist politics made most sense to me.
I'd wager, though, there's probably people listening to this and they're sitting in glass towers maybe Monday to Friday, and that's not a kind of a criticism of them. People would describe me maybe as a conformist as well, but they kind of grow out of that to a degree. That's how they might describe it. Yet you didn't. You stuck with it.
Yeah.
What does that say about you?
excuse me. I'm a Derby County fan in soccer, right?
Oh, here, yeah. eternal optimist, is it?
There's a certain eternal optimism in being a Derby County fan, particularly when they were relegated from the championship this year, and a sort of loyalism, you know, to you stick with somebody.
Yeah, okay.
So maybe it's that, I don't know. But to be honest, it's just more because I interrogated the ideas. And I maybe because I was in college at the time and all that, and I was interested in like philosophy and the world. So I interrogated the ideas about, so if there's really things wrong with the world, what is at the root of it? What's the problem with all these injustices and these inequalities? And the more I looked into it, the more I kind of became convinced of that analysis, that socialist analysis that goes right back to Connolly, James Connolly and Marx or whatever, that there's a fundamental problem with an economic system that puts profit first, that is built on fairly ruthless economic competition, that turns into military competition and war. It creates structured inequality, and that you need to tackle the system. And that convinced me, and it still convinces me. And I think once you're convinced of something, it's very difficult to turn away from it.
What was the reaction at the dinner table then when your father, David Boyd Barrett, an accountant, sat listening to you say that exact thing, that there is a capitalist system that puts profit above all else and ultimately leads to war. And we must upend this system.
Yeah, I think he, I mean, he certainly enjoyed the discussion. He didn't agree with me, you know. Yeah. He was coming from a different place politically. I think he liked the discussion. He himself was very interested in the world, in politics, yeah, and economics. So I learned a lot from him, even if we disagreed, and we'd have long debates and discussions about.
But it probably helped you clarify your own, like having, yeah, someone interrogate your view, I suppose, forces you to think about it.
Yeah.
In more detail.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I remember when I first sort of came across the socialists as well, I didn't sort of immediately jump and say, right, okay, I agree with everything you say. Okay, I spent, yeah, months and months interrogating them and being, you know, having to convince myself this is actually explains how the world works. And there were some other influences on me. I mean, I was big into sort of punk and reggae and ska music when I was younger, and that had also got a political edge to it. So I remember, like, in 1984, going to fundraising gigs not far from here, McGonagall's,
oh yeah,
venue,
yeah,
for the miners in 1984-85, which was an amazing thing. And there was also quite a lot of
the miners in the UK, yeah, like Arthur Scargill,
yeah, the British miners' strike. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the brilliant film Pride, it's on Netflix. I'd encourage everybody to, okay, go and see it. It's a fantastic film about the miners' strike and how an LGBT group in London started to raise money for the Welsh miners.
Oh, wow.
And how that challenged miners' perceptions of LGBT people, but it also kind of transformed the LGBT community to kind of begin to identify with other people in society who are suffering exploitation and exclusion. It's brilliant, brilliant film. But there was a lot of that as well with the kind of music scene at that time. So the interest in reggae music made you think about racism, and there was also a big part of that kind of punk music movement that was interested in the campaign for nuclear disarmament. So I remember going to gigs which were often raising funds, or where there was, you know, consciousness raising speeches, and some of the, yeah, artists and performers were talking about things like, you know, workers' rights and fighting against racism, fighting against militarism and war. And that would have had a big influence on me as well.
Does it ever get dispiriting, though, kind of fighting that fight?
That's a good question. Yeah.
It's kind of a Sisyphean.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing. If there's ever, yeah, if there's ever a thing that frustrates me, it's the housing crisis. Honest to God. I mean, it just infuriates me. Because it's so unnecessary. We're such a wealthy country, and yet to see the misery that people are going through. And I think, like, sometimes the debate gets caught up in statistics and, you know, plans and proposals.
Targets.
But when you actually, as I do, in, like, because you have clinics, and also because I represent an area that I know very well, so I know a lot of people in that area, and you meet people that you knew as a teenager, and families that you know of, they're friendly with, and relatives even, who suddenly are caught up with this absolute miserable situation of being faced with homelessness, being on housing lists for decades, being in overcrowded conditions where it's really impacting on their mental health, on the well-being of their kids. Mm. And you just think, this is disgraceful. It really is disgraceful. And that issue, more than anything, infuriates me. And I just cannot understand how, well, I do understand. Ultimately, I think it's because property interests, you know, people who make money from property are blocking the solutions to this. That's what I believe. But it is just infuriating. I mean, we're one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and we can't do the basic thing of provide people with secure housing. It's just shocking and totally unacceptable.
I think that the point at which we stray into policy is a good point to wrap things up.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're usually talking about. And I'm sure you'll be in, yeah, sometime soon to talk about these in more detail. Richard, it's been a pleasure. Thanks a million.
Thanks very much, Kieran.
Richard Boy Barrett, People for Profit, TD. On that note, we'll wrap things up as well for the Hard Shoulder today. My thanks to the production team, as always. Off the Ball, they're up next, and I'll be back tomorrow from 4. Have a great evening, folks.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.
High Five Casino lets you play your favorite slot and live table games, like blackjack, with the chance to redeem for real cash prizes. High Five Casino has a giant selection of over 1,200 games, including hundreds of exclusive games only found on High Five Casino. It's always free to play, and free coins are given out every 4 hours. Ready to have your own high-five moment? Visit HighFiveCasino.com. That's high, the number five, casino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.